Welcome to Charting the Course, a podcast from Full Sail Capital, dedicated to providing you with insights, assurance, and confidence to grow and manage generational wealth. Full Sail Capital is a fiduciary registered investment advisor managing more than $1 billion with a focus on integrity, competency, and transparency.
My guest today is Zach Reynolds. Zach is the Chief Investment Officer of Full Sail Capital and a CFA chartered holder. In this episode, we dive into the biases that influence investing behavior, specifically geographical and employer biases. As will be the case for most podcasts, you'll hear comments from Tyler Grubbs as he manages the production of each episode. I know you'll enjoy our conversation and hope it serves you along your journey. Zach, thanks for joining me today. So we're going to continue talking about biases. And whenever I say people have a familiarity bias, what does that mean to you?
In its most simple explanation, it's just investing in what you know best. And so that can manifest itself in a geographic bias where, you know, we're Americans and we know American companies. We know Coke and Procter & Gamble, so we're more likely to own those companies. The same can be true of regional differences as well. In our part of the world, we've all seen client portfolios that are heavily laden with energy stocks. Totally understandable from an investor standpoint. They think they know, you know, Devon and Continental and Chesapeake really well, so they're going to invest in that. However, it certainly is a bias relative to what we would consider an optimal portfolio.
One of the things I heard you say was buying what you know. And Peter Lynch, the great investor, did the Fidelity Magellan Fund, outperformed the market for so many years. That was one of his core principles, was invest in what you know. If I'm hearing you correctly, that may not be an optimal approach. Am I hearing you correctly with that statement?
Yes, and I think there's a big difference between Peter Lynch and the average investor as well. I mean, Peter Lynch had an incredible track record, was a very smart investor. And even then, I would argue, whether it's him or Warren Buffett, Bill Miller's another good example. Some of those guys had really good runs, and ultimately they come to an end. Look at Warren Buffett's investment results the last few years have not been good at all relative to a low-cost index fund. So for most people, I don't think just investing in what you know, particularly in a concentrated manner, is a good investment strategy.
And obviously this is a little bit of a ridiculous question, but then, so does that mean I should invest in what I don't know then?
I think that investors should recognize, and I think this is one of the hardest things to do. I mean, understand what you know and understand what you don't know. I would say for most people, hiring an advisor who has studied these things and acts as their fiduciary is the best way to go about creating an investment portfolio. I don't think you should buy what you don't know, but I think you should have a starting point. And for most investors, that starting point should be a cap-weighted index, whether that's, you know, a U.S. index like the S&P 500 or a more global index like the MSCI All Country World Index.
So backing up just a little bit, why does a familiarity bias exist in your opinion?
I think it's just human nature. We're more comfortable with what we know, what we're around, and I think that manifests itself here and in other places around the world.
So I guess whether or not it should exist is more or less an irrelevant question because if I hear you correctly, it's just going to exist.
That's right. The familiarity bias is one of dozens of biases that have been shown by psychologists and financial researchers and academics to affect investment portfolios. I mean, if you think about, you know, 30, 40 years ago, 50 years ago, when the field of study of finance was just getting up and running, the assumption was that people would invest rationally. Rational man will do this, right? Maximize return for a given level of risk. Well, the reality is, as research has gotten better and better, that's not how people work in the real world. And that's what's led to the field of behavioral finance. And it's a fascinating field of study that we use to help us create portfolios and advise clients, taking into account the fact that people are not perfectly rational when it comes to their money or anything else in their life.
So hasn't a familiarity bias benefited a majority of our investors by investing particularly in American or domestic stocks at that point?
Over the last decade or so, absolutely. U.S. stocks have outperformed international stocks. But, you know, we have a lot of clients who are in their 60s and 70s, and they would remember back to, let's say, 2003 to 2007, when emerging market stocks were absolutely the best performing asset class back then and added tremendous value to portfolios for those who were in emerging market stocks. While, yes, the question all the time lately is, why do I own any international stocks? You know, U.S. stocks seem to perform better. Our view remains that you can pick up some diversification value from investing internationally and have the opportunity to take advantage of outperformance in times like 2003 or 2007. And then I would argue as well, today, valuations for international stocks are much lower than what we see here in the U.S., and you know, that doesn't guarantee outperformance, but I think it gives us a little better chance.
So then how far down does that familiarity bias with a geographical tilt trickle? So Americans own more domestic stocks. Do people in other regions tend to own more regional stocks at that point?
Absolutely. There's a fascinating chart on visualcapitalist.com that shows regional differences in investors. West Coast folks, for example, own more technology stocks, and that's benefited them, versus people in the South who tend to own more energy stocks. That may change over time, and energy could outperform tech. Like we always talk about, Dexter, effectively, it's a bet, right? Those people, they may not realize they're making a bet, but if they own a bunch of Facebook and Amazon and Google, they're making a bet there versus a cap-weighted index, and they're either going to win or lose that bet.
So Dexter, let me chime in here, because yeah. I think something that I run into a lot is we've got some amazing companies just here locally that offer stock options and stock grants. And so you have this loyalty to the company because they've treated you right, and then you have this bias to continue to own that stock. And so a battle for me, and I'd like both of your opinion on this, a battle for me is, it's truly psychological. How do you get these clients and these people? Because again, we understand where they're coming from. We understand why they own the stock, but getting them to understand why it may not be the best idea to continue to hold your company stock options while you're employed there, while you're putting in retirement funds there. So how do you guys handle that when we get a client that has that situation?
Yeah, it's a great question. It definitely is a challenge, particularly if a company is doing well and people, they want to feel like they're part of a winning team.
I think the better the company's doing, the harder this is becomes.
Absolutely. I think ultimately though, and it's hard to make intellectual arguments because that doesn't always override someone's emotions.
Absolutely.
One of the first casualties of emotion is reason.
Bingo. But I think you can tell stories. And as advisors, we have the benefit of working with folks from, you know, all over the country, all many different industries. And we have seen what happens when you have a concentration in a particular individual stock. And many times it is the stock of the employer. We hate to see what's happened with Chesapeake here locally, but we all know people who had a lot of their retirement investments invested in Chesapeake stock. And ultimately, you know, it was great for a long time, but when the stock started going the other way, that destroyed a lot of value for people. So regardless of how confident you are in your company, you have to realize that a lot of that is out of your control. Chesapeake couldn't control that natural gas went from $12 to $2, right? That was not their fault. They could have been a super well-run company and the stock price still would have gotten hit very hard. So, you know, Tyler, there are often opportunities for people to, you know, make a contribution to their 401k, it gets matched in stock. And if that's the way to get it, I think that makes perfect sense. However, I think it's important to try to diversify that concentrated stock position as quickly as possible. And oftentimes we're in the position of telling people, even when the stock's going up, right? And Paycom comes to mind here, great company that's had great stock performance, but regardless of how it does, we know the right advice tends to be you should diversify, even if it means paying a little bit of tax, if it's an after-tax account, to reduce your risk.
For me, I had a guy one time who worked for GE for years, 30 years. That's the only company he ever worked for. His retirement was a fully vested amount of GE stock. There was no mutual funds or ETFs or money markets. It was all a GE stock. And this was probably back in 2014. And so GE was, at the time, I want to say $30 to $40 a share. And if you remember, a year or two ago, or when was it when they just completely got rocked?
Yeah, a few years back now.
17, 18. Yeah. And I was no longer working with this gentleman. I had moved on to a different firm. But I thought about him. And I thought about how many conversations I had with him about if something happens to GE stock, which was such a foreign concept to him.
How much control did he have over GE's shareholder return?
Zero.
The other thing I think that's important that we probably don't talk about enough is the value of human capital. So we all work for Full Sail Capital. So we our human capital is largely tied to our business, right? If Full Sail Capital also had stock and you were buying it, you'd be even more heavily weighted toward Full Sail Capital. The same is true. And I think the most tragic case would be something like Enron or WorldCom, right? Where those people were getting, buying stock options, getting granted stock options, feeling very wealthy, right? All their wealth was increasing as those stocks went up and up and up. And all of a sudden, you know, turns out a little bit of fraud here and there. Next thing you know, Enron and WorldCom are out of business. So those people are both out of a job and they've seen their wealth go to zero in some cases.
So I think one of the hard parts for me is intuitively, if I were starting a business, I would want all of my employees to be invested in the success of that business and ideally loyal to Wise Enterprises. Why wouldn't I want to compensate them with company stock to help themselves and help myself simultaneously?
It's a great question, and I agree with you. I think if I was a business owner, I would want to incentivize my employees that way. But we got to realize what's right for the company may not be right for the individual at the personal finance level. I think some level, particularly if it's stock grants that are, you know, vest over time, you know, some of that stuff is good, and a well-designed corporate compensation plan will account for this. But at the individual level, you still have to recognize that you don't have control over that stock price. And so it makes sense for you to try to diversify your holdings over time.
And I think that one of the things we've seen is that loyalty to companies changed to some degree throughout the years. So could you speak a little bit to whether certain cultures or generations have exhibited different biases in loyalty levels to companies?
Yeah, great question. I think certainly the, you know, greatest generation and then baby boomers to some extent envisioned, 30 plus years at a particular
company.
Getting
that gold watch.
That's right. Gold watch at retirement. I think we see turnover increasing today. I think we see companies changing much more quickly. And every worker has to kind of recognize that it's less likely today that you're going to spend your entire career at one company. And that has implications for how you invest your money, how you think about investing your retirement assets at a particular firm.
Would you recommend that so kind of back to what we were talking about with Tyler's client who's with GE, should the CEO of, or the CEO, or the owner of the company be invested and incentivized the same way as the employees then?
I think it makes more sense to have a CEO heavily invested or incentivized on behalf of shareholders to grow shareholder value, because the CEO ultimately is making decisions that directly affect the value of the stock. You can think about, and we can talk about Elon Musk all day, but his package with Tesla incentivized him to grow the market cap. And when the news came out of what it was, no one thought he could actually achieve some of these goals. Well, remarkably, he's done it, and he's going to make billions of dollars because of that. I think that incentive is fairly well aligned with shareholders and is a good thing versus someone who's on the Tesla manufacturing floor, although I guess they're all mostly robots at this point. But that sort of person, Tesla's a good example there too. Like, they probably have some people on the floor. I'm sure Elon Musk over time would like to eliminate those jobs. So does it make sense for that person to have as much Tesla stock? Maybe not.
So I think that it's safe to say that Elon Musk has achieved some generational wealth by investing in things that he knows. So I think that we have some clients who have achieved generational wealth, and we can talk about confirmation biases later, whether this was in spite of or because of investing in things that they knew. whenever we have either clients or prospects who are not willing to stop doing that, what is your response or approach to handling that situation where they want to continue investing in things that they know?
Right. I think we like to both incorporate what they're doing and then separate a little bit as well. So when I say incorporate, if someone has a private business that they own, we consider that an alternative investment in the sense that it's private equity. Let's say it's not a non-publicly traded stock. We want to take that into account when we're designing an investment portfolio. And even to the extent that, let's say someone is very heavily invested in real estate, and that's what they do. They go out and find properties and they add some value and they turn around and sell. Well, we might want to invest their portfolio a little differently. Maybe we don't have REIT exposure in it. So there are things we can do there. But ultimately, it's kind of the ironic part of our business. Like, a lot of our clients do get wealthy by having very concentrated stakes in companies. We don't get to see the flip side of that. The people who had very concentrated stakes in companies who weren't successful and then, you know, went bankrupt or whatever.
It's like the millionaire mind study saying that there is lots of millionaires have a high risk tolerance. There's also survivorship bias here, and there's a lot of bankrupt people who also have a high risk tolerance.
Bingo. That's exactly right.
At some point, we'll get into this because I think it's been a great book. And I know I mentioned it to Zach, but I'm reading this book called The Psychology of Money by Morgan Housel. And there is a chapter on risk versus luck. And it is incredible to see how I don't think enough people give risk or luck its due in the wealth management world, because there are so many times where right place, right time, wrong place, wrong time. So that's a whole other conversation, but I think that's something that's been fascinating lately.
I agree. And, you know, you read Bill Gates, you know, he talks about if he hadn't been growing up in the right place in Washington with access to the right computer lab, you know, it would have been someone else. We would never know Bill Gates's name.
Well, and to that point, Bill has a friend. His personality, he takes more risk because he's a rock climber. He just likes to go out and push the limit a little bit. He ends up passing away from a rock climbing accident. And Bill to this day says he would have been a billionaire with me because he was one of our partners.
Wow.
But he, based on risk and luck,
right,
wasn't with us. Like, it's just, it's fascinating.
It is
and
fascinating.
I don't think I like to give luck enough due because I like to think it's hard work and dedication. but it's not all, anyway, so.
Zach, I know you're busy. You got to get back to work here. What questions should clients be asking with regards to an advisor helping them reduce or manage their familiarity bias?
Yeah, good question too. I think particularly for people with concentrated assets in publicly traded companies or even private companies, I think talking to your advisor about how strategies to mitigate that risk. And it takes an advisor who can break down some of the risk factors, really understand what you're invested in, and then create a portfolio to mitigate some of that. So, you know, if you go to an advisor and they say, well, we have five portfolios, you know, you got to fit into one of them. Well, that may not be a great fit for you because you are already very exposed to energy or real estate or whatever it is, and it might make sense to lower your exposure. So that's where, particularly for high net worth people, I think it makes sense to work with a company or an advisor that has the ability to customize the portfolio to some extent.
I appreciate that, Zach. Thanks for your time today and look forward to the next podcast.
Thank you.
All opinions expressed by the host and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Full Sail Capital. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Clients of Full Sail may maintain positions in the securities discussed in this podcast. If you enjoyed today's conversation, please review and subscribe through your preferred podcast platform. Have a great week.